Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 184, Cool Heroes and Cool Heroism.
Hi, everybody. I'm today going to do a commentary on a specific chapter of the Vimalakirti Sutra. I'm doing a commentary on cool heroism, and it's something I came up with in my Inner Revolution book, which was my first trade book, as they call it, or popular book, as academics call it, although I don't know how popular it was. It was a bestseller in certain markets, let's say. In that, I came up with the theory of the Buddhist movement as a cool revolutionary movement, and that the type of revolutionary heroism that its protagonists pursued and developed is a heroism that is not violent, that just proceeds by morphic resonance, that makes the practitioner of the Dharma feel better, more realistic, more in tune with the basic positive reality of nirvana in the world, and feel more blissful, and therefore naturally attracts friends and is nice with them, and therefore increases their circle. And eventually this institutionally fits with the Buddhist community, and then this expands and it changes societies and it becomes revolutionary, making them less violent and more friendly and more happy and more joyful and with more beautiful arts and so forth, and also liberating women more, which makes life more beautiful and less militaristic. But unfortunately, up until the present day, also societies that went that way, like ancient India, many different societies, and then like Tibet and Mongolia more recently, such society, and indirectly China, Korea, Japan, societies that do turn that way become more vulnerable and less militarized. And so they've tended to disappear in history. And people have wrongly thought that being more open and more happy and more compassionate and more cool in your heroism, rather than hot heroism of militarism, but being more cool makes you vulnerable and is bad for you, therefore. And in a way that we have to admit that there has been a historical process of that type. However, in the long run, and today, when militarism is itself the problem, and no one can win a war, and they're just flailing and destroying everything. And so when I was promoting that book, you know, A Cool Revolution, at one point in some interview, someone asked me, well, where's all the cool heroes today? I mean, you mean Gandhi, Martin Luther King, et cetera, a few people who themselves got shot? What do you mean? What use? Why are you promoting that? And I wasn't even as clear then and as frank about the fact of even whole societies, like Tibetans were crossed by Chinese communists, Mongolians by Russian communists, and other countries by colonialists in general. In Asia, other more peaceful countries in Asia by colonialists. So I didn't even go to that level, but I was like a little bit gasping for thing. And then I suddenly had a revelation, which I too stupidly hadn't really noticed deeply enough, although I knew it sort of intellectually. But I thought about women in every family throughout the whole planet who are the cool heroes that hold that family together. Because the men in the family in violence-oriented societies, that is to say militarism or societies, even a nation as defined by political sciences, as where the government has the monopoly on legal violence in its borders, so even a nation is defined by the ownership of violence, as if it's an inevitable thing. But nevertheless, the families in that, And in many cases, the societies are held together by the glue of the peaceful warrior, the woman, who often gets brutalized, actually, but she also mutes the brutality between father and son, brother and brother, which son and father, which would tear families apart. And, you know, societies would be unviable without the presence of those grandmothers and those mothers and those wives and those sisters. It would be unviable. And so they actually are the cool heroes, and they are therefore actually 50% of humanity. So anyway, this chapter begins, it's called the Goddess Chapter. The whole teaching of Vimalakirti is he's an enlightened layperson who's almost as eloquent as the Buddha himself and as deep a teacher, but he's a layman, so he's a lower in status. But he's a friend and partner of the Buddha. He doesn't compete with him. And he defers to the Buddha because the Buddha, by dropping out of the social system, has put the creative community into a kind of tension with the social system to engage the revolution. And whereas Vimalakirti is doing it within a great city there called Vaishali, and from within, as a lay person within the system. But yet he always, he's always like contributes from that angle. So he and Buddha are like two sides of an anvil, you know, anvil and hammer situation, you know. So anyway, he and Manjushri, who is the Bodhisattva of perfect wisdom, are having a conversation about the nature of the reality of beings. And he says, well, the way that the enlightened person, a Bodhisattva, regards beings as a little bit unreal. Quite unreal even, you know, in the sense that they don't know who they are, the ordinary being, and what they think they are, what their reality is not what their real reality is, because they think their reality is something that suffers and something that's frustrated, something that's separate from the universe, whereas what they really are is a being of bliss, made of bliss, in a blissful universe, completely free and exquisite and beautiful. And inner bliss is what their life force is, even. But they don't know that, so therefore they're freaking out a lot. So he gives the talk like that. And so then Manjushri does the logical thing. He says, well, if a Bodhisattva considers all living beings in such a way as sort of unreal, how does he generate the great love toward them? How can he love them? And then he says, Manjushri, when a Bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, he thinks, just as I have realized the Dharma, which makes me realize the relative unreality of suffering and suffering beings as suffering beings. It doesn't mean they don't exist, it just means they have a certain level of unreality. And that made me happy when I realized that our suffering is unreal and our bliss is what's real, is what he's saying. You know, so should I teach it to living beings, he says. Thereby, he generates the love so that they will realize what their real reality is, and they'll really be happy, which is what love wants people to do. Love wants the beloved to be happy. So how can you make beings happy? You cannot make them happy in a lasting way just by giving them this and that, unless you give them the ability and the circumstances and the evidence and the vision, you know, the opportunity for the vision to see themselves as happy and to understand where their happiness is, which is already within them. That's how you do it. And then that gives them lasting happiness, you know. And, you know, it's like, as they say, the difference between giving someone a fish or teaching them how to find the fish themselves. So thereby he generates the love that is truly a refuge for all living beings, the love that is peaceful because free of grasping, the love that is not feverish because free of passions, the love because it is passion, so it's not driven by passion, the love that accords with reality because it is equanimous in all three times, the love that is without conflict because free of the violence of the passions, the love that is non-dual because it is involved neither with the external nor the internal, the love that is imperturbable because totally ultimate, because it's a love that sees the happiness in beings as already there and wills them to discover it themselves, which will make them permanently happy and fully happy and inexhaustibly happy. Then he goes on, I'm skipping because I want to come to the love that is enlightenment because it is unity of experience. There are many great descriptions of love in this passage. So then he says, that's such great, you know, so he says, the love that is happiness because it introduces living beings to the happiness of the Buddha. Such, Manjushri, is the great love of a Bodhisattva. So Manjushri accepts that beautiful passage. And then he says, well then, Vimalakirti, Mr. Vimalakirti, what is the great compassion of the Bodhisattva? And then Vimalakirti says, it is the giving of all accumulated roots of virtue to all living beings. So any virtue, any good thing you do, you share that with beings. Then he says, what is the great joy of the Bodhisattva? He says, it is to be joyful and without regret in giving. And then he says, what is the equanimity of the Bodhisattva? And he says, it is what benefits both self and others. So these are this love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. These are what are called the four immeasurables in any kind of Buddhism. And they are states of magnanimity and greatness and happiness. And they sort of intensify. And love fits with compassion, which can't bear for the beloved to suffer. Compassion fits with joy, which sees the bliss and happiness in the beloved, even though the beloved may not yet be fully aware of it. And then equanimity means where one sees this equally in all beings, so that one wants all of them to find that joy in, that is their basic nature. And so he gives them. Then he says, and then even you're equal yourself with others in your joy. That's about equanimity. So to what should one resort when terrified by fear of life? Which ordinary beings often are. And he says, Manjushri, Bodhisattva who is terrified by fear of life, should resort to the magnanimity of the Buddha. Or where should he who wishes to resort to the magnanimity of the Buddha take his stand? And Vimalakirti says, he should stand in equanimity toward all living beings. Where should he who wishes to stand in equanimity toward all living beings take his stand? He should live for the liberation of all living beings. Oh, and where, what should he who wishes to liberate all living beings do? He should liberate them from their passions. How should he who wishes to eliminate passions apply himself? He should apply himself appropriately. How should he apply himself to apply himself appropriately? He should apply himself to productionlessness and to destructionlessness. That is, by seeing the true infinite joy and bliss and clear light and relative nature of all things, realize that nothing is ever, no isolated, intrinsically separated thing is ever produced, and therefore no thing can ever be destroyed. What is not produced and what is not destroyed? Evil is not produced and good is not destroyed, he says. Evil is not produced and good is not destroyed, meaning evil only comes from some being that thinks that it is separate from other beings, and feels therefore frightened of them, or wants to dominate them, or wants to consume them, or get them under its control, and therefore is harmful to them, which is what evil is. And good is never destroyed, because good comes from the feeling of connection between all beings. And once you're connected to all beings, you can never harm them. So that's very simple in a way, but very nice. So then he says, Manjushri says, what is the root of good and evil? And he says, and this is surprising, he says, materiality is the root of good and evil. And by materiality, he means the grasping of something as materially separate and apart from everything else is what he really means by it. You know, rather than fluidity, interconnectedness. This is the material thing. This is me. This is separate. You know, and he says, what is the root of materiality? And he says, well, greed is the root of materiality. And what is the root of desire and attachment? And he says, unreal construction is the root of desire. Meaning when your unreal construction of yourself is a separate thing, needing other things because you feel separate from them, so you feel you need them in this artificial reaching across separation way, and then you become you become greedy for them. And what is the root of unreal construction? The false concept is the root. And what is the root of the false concept? Baselessness. It says, or rootlessness, you could say. And what is the root of baselessness? And he says, Manjushri, when something is baseless, how can it have any root? Therefore, all things stand on the root which is baseless. So in other words, the sense of being rooted in some fixed thing apart from other things, you are rooted in a sense of emptiness or baselessness, which then makes you connected to all things. Your root is your connection to all things. And basically, he's saying like that. But anyway, this is a very deep dialogue in any language. The Zen people and the Taoists in China really loved this when it was translated like this. But anyway, that's just to give the atmosphere of where then the action takes place that I'm really reading about my ideal cool hero in one way.
Greetings and salutations, Podcast Wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded September 2018 at the home of Nena and Robert Thurman. This podcast is adapted from a video broadcast that Professor Thurman did that is available on Facebook, and it's also posted on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. This teaching on cool heroism and cool heroes and how the Vilmukirti Sutra relates to Bob's earlier book, Inner Revolution, was edited and adapted for this audio form. Be sure to like, subscribe, and follow Tibet House US and Robert Thurman on social media, and especially on YouTube and Facebook, where the entire teaching is posted. But I think you'll enjoy the video version. You get to see Bob in his prime, enjoying teaching from one of his favorite texts. Bob also has several past episodes of his podcast that cover Vilmukirti Sutra. Several of them are titled Vilmukirti's Verses, or just do a search by Vilmukirti. We'll have a link in the podcast description to make it easier to find all those past episodes. Also included in that podcast description is a link to the free e-edition of the Vilmukirti Sutra, which Bob is teaching from in this episode. Be sure to download it and look at the other interesting Buddhist texts that are available on that website. Bob's very excited and happy to support such a great effort to bring the Buddhist Dharma teachings to a wider audience digitally online. Second half of this week's episode, Bob's going to pick up the teaching right where he left off. Then afterwards, there's a special extended segment of Gary Gok reading some poetry that's very dear to his heart, and it relates to other past poems that he's read in the podcast. As I've mentioned in the past couple weeks, Gary's got a brand new book out, and if you like his readings and want to learn more about the intersection of mindfulness, Buddhism, and poetry, be sure to check out his new book, Pause, Smile, Meditate, available through Sounds True. I'll link that in the podcast description so it's easy to find. And as always, the Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part for the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Benefits include special VIP invites to Tibet House US member events, such as the GOX trip to Sri Lanka in 2019 and the annual Tibet House US benefit auction, happening December 10th in New York City at Tibet House US. To learn more about this annual benefit, please visit tibethouse.us. And as always, the interstitial music is provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and Gary in the second half of this week's episode.
Thereupon a certain goddess who lived in that house, having heard this teaching of the Dharma of the great heroic Bodhisattvas, and being delighted, pleased, and overjoyed, manifested herself in a material body and showered the great spiritual heroes, the Bodhisattvas, and the great disciples with heavenly flowers. She comes and scatters celestial flowers, really exquisite ones, they're with great scent and everything. So anyway, then I will compress this. So then the monks who are there are upset, having flowers scattered on them, which are sticking to their clothes and their robes. because as monks they're not allowed to wear ornaments or flower garlands and things like that. So they're shaking them off, but they're sort of sticking to them by like static electricity. And the other bodhisattvas, they're just flowing over them and there's no problem. So the goddess says to Shariputra, the head monk, "Why are you shaking your robes and acting all crazy?" And he says, "Well, I'm doing that because the flowers are not proper." And she says, "Well, Shariputra, it's improper for one who has renounced the world for the discipline of the accurately taught Dharma, the teaching about reality, consists of constructed thought and discrimination. And yet you elders are full of such thoughts, even though you think you attain nirvana. One who is without such thoughts is always proper." And then they go on like that, you know. But in other words, she challenges his sort of rigid conceptual structuring of reality, where he is a monk who has found a place to escape in through meditation from structured reality, the way he structures it, where he thinks it's a veil of suffering and of improprieties. And she's saying, no, it's your construct of the world that's at fault there, even your construct of nirvana and samsara being separate. She's going to get to that. But she starts here, and then he protests. And then when she makes a point by showing his wrong rigidity and discrimination, and he changes the subject like male chauvinists always do. And then he says, like, "Well, how long have you been in the house, living here in this house of Vimalakirti?" Because she was invisible before this, because she's like a goddess, you know. And he said, "Well, I've been here as long as the elder has been in liberation of nirvana," she says. And then he goes, "Well, then have you been in the house for quite a while?" Because, of course, he thinks he did have a magnificent meditative experience of being in a vast space as if it was apart from the world, and he thinks that's what nirvana is, because in a dualistic way. And she knows that, and so she's saying, "Well, how long?" And then he says, he doesn't want to say a specific time, but he says, "Have you been here for quite a while?" And then the goddess said, "Oh, has the elder been in liberation of nirvana for quite some time?" At that, the elder Shariputra felt silent. And then she challenges, however. She doesn't go for the silence. She says, "Elder, you are said to be foremost of the wise. Why do you not speak? Now, when it is your turn, you do not answer my question." And then he said, well, since liberation is inexpressible, goddess, I do not know what to say." In other words, this state that I achieved is inexpressible, and it felt inexpressible when I achieved it. And then I returned from it. I don't know why, but therefore I can't say anything about it. But I'm thinking it's there, and I'm here. But he's not saying that. But this. So then she says, "Don't take resort to inexpressibility." She says, "All the syllables pronounced by the elder have the nature of the liberation of nirvana." So language is not separate from nirvana, is what she's saying. Why? Liberation is neither internal nor external, nor can it be apprehended apart from the internal and the external. So there's no separation, in other words, no separate state of bliss apart from this state of supposed suffering. Likewise, syllables are neither internal nor external, nor can they be apprehended anywhere else. Therefore, Reverend Shariputra, do not point to liberation by abandoning speech. Why? The holy liberation is the equality of all things. Then he argues back. He says, "Goddess, is not liberation the freedom from desire, hatred, and folly of ignorance?" And she says, quote, "Liberation is freedom from desire, hatred, and folly," end quote. That is the teaching for the excessively proud, i.e. you, because you're so proud of yourself, you think you achieved nirvana, you see, and you put that in your discriminatory structure as being something beyond the universe, and yet it's a state that you experienced, and you broke into it, so it had a boundary, and now you're back out from it, back in a world that's ordinary. So that's your discrimination, she said. So then you're proud, but then you think there's some, here you're caught up in desire, hatred, and folly, but there you won't be, you'll be free of that in that other place. Until you've wrongly absolutized your experience. But she doesn't say this in all so many words. She just says, "But those free of pride are taught that the very nature of desire, hatred, and folly is itself liberation." So in other words, liberation is even in seemingly negative emotions, if you understood them, if you understood what those energies truly are, not when you're gripped by them and driven by them to do stupid, greedy, or angry, or depressed things, but when you know what they are, and you realize that even they are made of this bliss, because nirvana is the uncreated, you know, beginningless nature of everything anyway. But she doesn't, again, doesn't say it so extreme. She just says that he agrees with her, though. He sort of senses this is correct. He says, excellent, excellent goddess. But then again, he changes the subject. He says, pray, what have you attained? What have you realized that you have such eloquence? And she says, I have attained nothing, Reverend Shariputra. I have no realization, and therefore I have such eloquence. Whoever thinks I have attained, I have realized, is overly proud in the discipline of the well-taught Dharma. So great, you know? And then he says, then again he changes in a way indirectly, but he's kind of trying to get her story. He says, Goddess, do you belong to the disciple vehicle or the solitary vehicle or the great vehicle? In other words, to the dualist vehicles of the disciples and the hermit Buddhas, or do you, the great vehicle of the Bodhisattvas, the non-dual great vehicle? She says, I belong to the disciple vehicle when I teach it to those who need it. I belong to the solitary sage vehicle when I teach the 12 links of dependent origination to those who need them. And since I never abandon the great compassion, I belong to the great vehicle, as all need that teaching to attain ultimate liberation of nirvana, she says. So that shows again that the non-dual form of, you know, the non-dual ultimate form of Buddha's teaching does not negate his preliminary forms, which are still dualistic, but some people need them, whatever they need. It's not dogma Buddhism. It's therapy. So whatever people need. And then she goes on, yeah, but really, it's always wonderful things here, and really the universal vehicle, the great vehicle, is really the great one, and that's the one I really like. And these eight wonderful things are here in the house of Vimalakirti. She tells, but I'm going to skip this because it'll be too long if I do it. But it's quite beautiful, actually. What she describes as the house of Vimalakirti is actually what happens in a mandala. A golden hue shines there consequently. Anyone who enters there has no sort of disturbance from his inner addictive passions and emotions. The gods are all present here, and they're blessing everyone here. The sounds of all the gods are there. The gods. Don't think Buddhism doesn't have gods. They are. They're all there. All the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas also. Yeah, it's never empty. It has a great soundtrack, great sound system. The sounds of the Dharma are always there. It's a music of that type. Also, there's regular music. You always hear the rhythms, songs, and musics of gods and men. And there are also four treasures in the house, replete with every jewel, which never decrease, although the poor and the wretched may partake to their satisfaction. That's the sixth strange and wonderful thing. And then also Buddhas of all the 10 directions will come to the house, and they will teach the secrets of the Tathagata, the esoteric teachings of the immediacy of enlightenment, and then depart. That's the seventh one. And finally, all the splendors of the abodes of the gods and all the splendors of the fields of the Buddhas shine forth in this house. And that's the eighth strange and wonderful thing. And Shariputra, these eight things are here. So who then, seeing such inconceivable things, would believe the teaching, dualistic teaching, that bliss and beauty and liberation and nirvana is somewhere else when you live in a mandala house like this, she says. You know? So then finally, he loves that too, because he's in the house. After all, they're having this conversation in Vimalakirti's magical house. It's like a Doctor Who house, Vimalakirti's house, like a TARDIS. Like, this looks like a regular house on the street in the city of Vaishali, you know, with its garden around it, so the big mansion. But inside, it's infinite, and there's infinite numbers of rooms, and it's huge, and thousands of people can go in, etc. It's a magic house like that. It's a shunyata house containing all of relativity, you could say, an emptiness house. And so he's in there, so, you know, in a way, he loves that she talks about these eight strange and wonderful things that are always in the great vehicle house of Vimalakirti. So then he says, Goddess, which is, and that's admitting that she's obviously supremely enlightened herself. She's a female Buddha herself. But he says, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? He says, because to him and in male chauvinist societies, even in the language, the female embodiment is a lower embodiment, and like the lower being, they say, the lower human is the female. Really, that's in all these patriarchal languages, even in Sanskrit, you know, even in Tibetan, it is in there. You know, and she says, although I have sought my female state for these 12 years, I have not found it. So she's not identifying herself as female, intrinsically really female. Reverend Shariputra, if a magician were to incarnate a woman by magic, would you ask her, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? Shariputra says, no, such a woman would not really exist. So what would there be to transform? So she says, just so, Reverend Shariputra, all things do not really exist. Now would you think, what prevents one whose nature is that of a magical incarnation from transforming herself out of her female state? Thereupon the goddess employed her magical power to cause the elder Shariputra to appear in her form and to cause herself to appear in his form. Then the goddess transformed into Shariputra, said to Shariputra transformed into the goddess, Reverend Shariputra, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? And Shariputra transformed into the goddess replied, I no longer appear in the form of a male. My body has changed into the body of a woman. I do not know what to transform. So she's showing the relationality and the constructedness of embodiment by creating this magical illusion in his mind, which is only a substitute for the regular magical illusion of our discriminatory, ignorance-dominated minds, misknowledge-dominated minds. We think we're really this and that, but we're wrong, is what she's saying. So the goddess continued, if the elder could again change out of the female state, then all women could also change out of their female states. All women appear in the form of women in just the same way as the elder appears in the form of a woman. While they are not women in reality, they appear in the form of women. With this in mind, the Buddha said, in all things, there is neither male nor female, which doesn't mean that in the world of relative unreality, there aren't males and females, but that means they're not ultimate conditions, and they're equally mutable between male and female. And therefore, a male has a female possibility, female has a male possibility completely, and both embody both things in a way, really, you can say. And she shows him that viscerally by this sort of magician's, you know, visionary thing, which she, power which she has, because of her enlightenment, she's completely connected to him. She's not really putting him down. She's kind of almost entering his mind and showing him the relativity of his body, that it's completely transformable, and showing him in a different body and herself in a different body to overcome at a visceral level his sense of dualism, you see. And by seeing that, then she's getting him subliminally to question his rigid view that he's in a world of suffering, awful world, which at varying points during the sutra he encounters, that even though he's personally attained what he thought was nirvana, and he was perfectly blissful in that state, temporarily, but it was only temporary because it was only like a threshold attainment of nirvana. And the real one is only where you attain nirvana in the midst of all of this, in the midst of your interconnectivity with all beings, so that you are there near, you are near, you in a way, you are one with the nirvana that is their own true nature, and which makes you able, like a Buddha or a Bodhisattva in the inconceivable liberation, to really help them realize that's their true nature themselves. How could you really help them do that unless you could initially experience their own reality as being that? So that's why she has the ability to make that magic. It isn't like an external manipulative thing, as if he's just someone she's trying to put down and do something. She's just trying to put him in her shoes in the most visceral sort of way. So this is a very powerful example of really the how cool heroism functions by placing the person who thinks of them as departed in, you know, in their shoes, by being able to do so, by being in the shoes and being truly loving. She's being truly loving to Shariputra. She's introducing Shariputra to the fluidity and flexibility and the nirvana-ishness of ordinary reality, the non-duality of nirvana and samsara is what she's really doing. And there's a beautiful long exchange that she switches him back, and then she says, Shariputra, what have you done with your female form? And he says, I neither made it nor did I change it. And just so all things are neither made nor changed in reality. In unreality, they seem to be, but they're not really that way. And that they are not made and not changed, that is the teaching of the Buddha. So that means that this show of relationality, of separate beings banging into each other, fearing each other, being greedy for each other, harming each other, thinking they are really that way, all of that is something like a movie. It's like an unreal thing. And once you know that, though, then you, as part of it, you see it as a play of bliss, though. So then you don't just leave it. You don't think you can leave it. And you don't think that part of it, of the show, is that there's a place apart from it that's a great place. Its own nature is that place. You come to this inexpressible, which, of course, is inexpressible. So I'm expressing non-duality in some way. But there's the next chapter in Vimalakirti where two chapters later, is where he shows how non-duality is inexpressible, actually. So this is the cool hero thing. So I'm just saying this and giving this commentary on this. Between the Vimalakirti and the goddess, between Shariputra and the goddess, and, just so, Reverend Shariputra, it is impossible, she ends, that I should attain the perfect enlightenment of Buddhahood. Why? Because he's saying it's impossible that he could ever be an ordinary person, because he's had an experience of a certain kind of nirvana, a limited form of nirvana, but not the total, all-embracing one. But she says, that just so, Reverend Shariputra, it is impossible I should attain. So she says, well, why? Because perfect enlightenment stands upon the impossible. Because it is impossible, no one attains the perfect enlightenment of Buddhahood. And then he argues back, he says, but the Tathagata has declared, the Tathagatas, that means the reality, the ones who have realized the nature of reality, the Tathagatas, which is the name of Buddhas, who are as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, have attained perfect Buddhahood, are attaining perfect Buddhahood, and will go on attaining perfect Buddhahood. Reverend Shariputra, the expression, the Buddhas of past, present, and future, is a conventional expression made up of a certain number of syllables. The Buddhas are neither past, nor present, nor future. Their enlightenment transcends the three times. But tell me, elder, have you attained sainthood? And then Shariputra kind of gets it and said, it is attained because there is no attainment. And then she agrees with him, just so. There is perfect enlightenment because there is no attainment of perfect enlightenment, as if it were something separate from other things, you know. So then Vimalakirti says to Shariputra to calm him down. Shariputra, Reverend Shariputra, he always treats him with great respect, even though he's challenged always in his vision of dualism. He says, Reverend Shariputra, this goddess has already served 92 million billion Buddhas. She plays with the super knowledges. She has truly succeeded in all her vows. She has gained the tolerance of the birthlessness of all things. She has actually attained irreversibility. She can live wherever she wishes on the strength of her vow to develop living beings. So these are the cool heroines, which is all of you who unrealistically but relatively are existing as females. And you have been ignored, and your vision and your heroism has been ignored and is still being ignored. Even in our wonderful democratic, all beings are equal, all humans are equal. Actually, all beings are equal, but at least all humans are equal. And now you're going to make yourself heard, and you are going to get to the polls, every single one of you. And you're going to vote, and you're going to not vote for anyone who will not listen to your voice. And you're going to help clean up the imbalance that is afflicting our society, where some people are afflicted by the misery of too much wealth, and some people are afflicted by the misery, and more people are afflicted by the misery of too little wealth. But all of them are afflicted, actually. It isn't that we're against one for the other. We just want to rebalance things. And there might be some a little more wealthy and some a little less wealthy, there's no doubt. That's fine, we're not against that. But it shouldn't be so imbalanced, and no one should be really, really poor, and nobody should be impossibly wealthy. The only impossibly wealthy ones are the ones who see the whole universe as made of wealth, and live or die, they live in a jewel mandala, and that's it, those are enlightened ones. And those are impossibly wealthy, actually, perhaps. So nothing is impossible, so I shouldn't say that. And those people are impossibly wealthy, right? Because they identify with all life and all beings. And that's what you do more than the males. And therefore, the males now need you to lead them out of their excessive rigidities and separations and discriminations and prejudices and biases and confusions. Okay? So cool heroism is here, and it must win now. And it has been winning, actually. And there are just certain ones who are so confused that they see their liberators as somehow imprisoners, and they therefore are fighting against that desperately, crazily. And it's time for them to lose and find the joy of the consolation of the joy of loss, of loss of false views, of loss of suffering, of loss of ignorance, greed, and anger. Okay? So all the best to all of you. Have a happy time. Thank you very much.
I've been working on presenting into English the work of a Korean gentleman by the name of Ko Un, who looks like this, if you can see. He's born in 1933, he's in his 70s, and I'm going to launch tonight this book, Flowers of a Moment. But before I do, I'd like to read just a couple of things to give you some context. I'll start with a poem that I got out of the blue, as it were, when I was calling. There was a call for poems that I put out. The title, it's What Book?, which is an anthology of poems from 1950 to today, influenced by sobriety and awakening and what's called the Buddha. So I got this poem, and you can imagine how I felt. It's entitled Ripples. Look, do all the ripples move because one ripple starts to move? No. It's just that all the ripples move at once. Everything's been askew from the start. So I published four poems by this guy with great pleasure, satisfaction. This was why I was creating the space for these kinds of poems to exist. And I learned more about him. And a quick rehearsal of his life is as follows. He was born in Gunsan in Jeolla province in 1933 at a time when the country was occupied by Japanese colonialists. And he learned his language in secret because the language was banned. And so I'm reading tonight the work of a person whose own language was banned. And if you ever hear him read, he kind of reads like a person coming from a cave. It's a fantastic experience. I recommend it. So a quick recital of his life is like a quick recital of Korean history. And in a nutshell, he was conscripted in the war to do the most terrible things, as happens in war, which drove him to a monastery. And he became a monk and rose to high attainment after walking as a mendicant over the entire countryside by foot, seeing the ravages of war. And 10 years later, he disrobed. He renounced or just became a lay person again, largely to do with the corruption that he saw in the institutionalization of what we call Zen in Korea is called Sun, because they had it for 100 years before it became Zen. And then he fell into a period of great despair until his nihilism was replaced by activism. This is a poem about, well, there are poems about bandits and beggars and the future president of Korea, who he was a jailmate with, and merchants and fisher folk and the wives of fisher folk and the kids of the grandparents and, you know, the whole, you know, Bruegelian tree of life. But he also includes the town frog, the village dog, and the little spring. Without its little spring, what would make Yongtun village a village? Endlessly snowflakes fall into the spring's dark waters and dissolve. What still, still stillness, as Yang Sul's wife, covered in snow, goes out to draw water, puts down her tiny little water jar, and picks up the gourd dipper, but forgets to draw water, watching snowflakes die. That still, still stillness. So maybe I'll read one more, but if we have time, I'd like now to present to you, ladies and gentlemen, the latest book by Go Eun is entirely different from that one. He's written 135 books. He's like a waterfall. This one is a collection of 185 what he calls brief poems. You could call them Zen poems, and there's an introduction which was impossible to translate, but we finally did it, which he wrote just for this edition. There's editions in different languages. This was just recently named the best book of the year in Sweden. It's remarkable in many ways, and since I've never read it before and may never read it again, I'll say as little as possible so that it can speak for itself, but I'll just say two things. One is that none of these little or short, they're not little, okay? Nothing is little, okay? You may be small, but you're not little. You may be short, but you're not little. None of these brief poems, as they occur in the book, relate to the next one, which is, you know, pretty remarkable, because in all the magazine appearances, they would pull some together and make these little stories out of them, you know, which you can do when you have that many to draw from. But he's managed to keep them all like stars in a sky that are all separate, and you can make whatever connections between them. The more you read, the vaster that space becomes, which I guess leads to the other thing I was going to say, which is, pardon me for talking so fast, but I'm excited. The introduction talks about his Zen background and how in Zen, you know, there's no words, but I just use words to say that. So apparently there's no dualism between silence and speech. So these poems come out of that that space, that silence. And what I'll do is I'll read the first three so you get a sense of just this kind of wonderful discreteness of how each one has its own address. And then I'll just go through the whole book, kind of picking some along the way, hopefully with no connection. Flowers of a Moment. At sunset, only one wish, to become a wolf beneath a fat full moon. I have spent the whole day being someone else's story again. As I journey homeward, the trees are watching me. Exhausted, the mother has fallen asleep, so her baby is listening all alone to the sound of the night train. In Mount Karawang in Cheongsan Kangwon province, the falling streams are busy, but busier are the minnows, the carplings, swimming upwards against the current. Rowing with just one oar, I lost that oar. For the first time, I looked round at the wide stretch of water.
I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment has been a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Tashi Dell.